Can you hear me?
We're all in. Continue as you will.
I was just saying that if you read Stephen King's Dark Tower, it's a very similar idea. It basically rips off the Eye of Sauron, but it's where you read it, it's just in something, this presence that can see everything. It's sort of like Santa Claus, you know? It's like he can see you if you're, you know, when you're sleeping or some shit like that. But basically, it's the idea that it's just something that is always watching you, not necessarily something that you can also see.
Yeah. Santa Claus sees all, but no one sees Santa Claus.
Exactly.
It's a terrifying thing to fucking tell a child. You know, Santa Satan is just that's too direct. That doesn't feel like an accident to me. That's an example of that.
Well, Santa Claus is Saint Nick, right? And Saint Nick is the guy that's drunk and gambling and doing shitty. Well, he's, you know, having a good time all year, and then as penance, he goes around and gives all the kids Amanita muscaria, right? I mean, presents. Sorry.
Well, isn't that? I was thinking when you were talking about the story where the God sings the world into existence, and then the bad guy tries to create bad music. I was thinking about Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, where it really is the devil is named Nick, and Nick tries to stop them from singing the song of the universe.
Right. And then he's like, somebody's always telling a story somewhere. You can't. Nothing's gonna stop the flow, dude.
That's right.
And David, if you're interested in Santa Claus as Satan, you should look into a character named Krampus.
I think. I have. I don't want to look at the Krampus anymore. So scary. Oh, I can't take it. I can't take Krampus. I can take a lot, but I can't take Krampus. I don't know how they do that. That's the weirdest. Like, oh man. There's no, they're not even like trying to, you know, lure kids into like something to bring about a subconscious terror. They just are out with it. They're just like, be scared, kids. I mean, Santa Claus at least gives the appearance that it's like okay until it embeds itself, you know.
Yeah, until we try to slip the bottle of Coke up your ass or something.
Right.
I don't know what that guy is doing.
I don't know either, but I can equate Coca-Cola with Santa Claus pretty easily because of my conditioning. Or polar bears.
Didn't Coca-Cola invent the red and white Santa Claus? As part of their campaign?
I thought Catholicism did.
Yeah. Well, not in the red and white, though, I don't think. I think it was a marketing campaign next to all those nice big red trucks. They had Santa Claus in red and white like the Coke can.
From what I understand, there already was a correlation with red and white in this character because of the Amanitas, right? The Amanita is red and white, but that he was always depicted wearing black clothing. He would have the black clothing, but the Amanitas were red and white. And I believe it was Coca-Cola was the first to put him in red and white.
Huh.
I could have that wrong. That's what I remember. When I researched it a few years ago, that's what I remember.
Yeah. I've always seen St. Nick in sort of a multicolored kind of big cloak, you know?
Mm. His amazing Technicolor dream coat.
Exactly, yeah.
Huh.
St. Nick, anyways.
I'm trying to look up cola right now in Hebrew. I'd come across that and I was like, it had a significance.
It'd probably be South American cola. The cola bean.
Right. Well, the actual, yeah, I know it's not from there, but I thought it was an interesting little connection. To be finished, completed. Yeah, to complete something. That's interesting. Extinction, extermination, annihilation, destruction.
Coke.
To destroy them entirely. No,
get out. That's hilarious.
Cola means extinction in Hebrew. That's interesting.
Just that like
new Coke or old Coke. Yeah.
There was my what's his fucking name? The other lizard guy who just basically takes like stuff. Sarin?
What's his name? Sauron?
No, there's
like the bad Gandalf.
No, there's a
you know
guy.
What I mean? There's like a wizard that's Gandalf is the good wizard, and then there's a bad wizard. Saruman.
Saruman, yeah.
Right, I'm talking about the other David Icke type researcher. Oh. Researcher, he just reads other books about reptilians and invents them like they're his own.
Michael
Something
Sarin,
I thought his name was.
Okay.
He was like, I get bothered with that guy because I'll look up shit that he says and it's like, what? No. But he said that Coca-Cola meant dick in Egyptian. And I mean, it still could, and I may not have found it, but I was like, okay, what? Like, yeah, I don't know. He's like he likes to point out that he's like these things don't mean anything in English, but they mean other things in other languages, and it's like, well, yeah, you know. But then he was like saying a cold meaning is like, yeah, like I thought that some of them were interesting. Like he'd say like fila is like olive back, right? So like olive fila and whatever, but I don't know how all of his information leads to there is definitely reptilians underground. I mean, there could be. I'm not denying that, but I get annoyed with it. Anyways, I thought that was interesting. Coca-Cola means dick in Egyptian. Who's going to do that? Who's going to go look up and pull out their Egyptian dictionary? I'll take your word for that.
Yeah, I didn't. I've never heard him say that. I'm not actually a big fan of him either. I think he lays out some interesting stuff, but I think it was Freeman who was playing with Pepsi, and you know, there's the Egyptian figure Apep, APEP. So he was saying that like when you have Pepsi or even like Dr. Pepper, where it says, "Don't you want to be a pepper to a pep?" You have this idea that this.
Serpent in the underworld?
Say again?
Isn't he the serpent in the underworld?
Correct, yes. Correct, yes.
Yeah. So ride the snake, literally. He follows you, you're riding along in the underworld, and he's the one following you that you basically, you have to learn to work with. You can't be completely against him. You gotta go with the flow. The sea refuses. There's no river. Yeah, to the apex.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting because actually Apep is the serpent that goes around. So you have this idea of the underworld, but also rising out of the underworld. Now you could see that maybe if you're a company that wants to play with energy drinks, right, like caffeine, you have this idea of rising out of the underworld. So don't if you feel all groggy and things like that, we're going to give you something that helps you rise. This is why you. Sunny delight, right? This is the sunshine, the rising sun. This is why you have a pep. You know, maybe it's giving you pep, like which of course is doesn't have to be Egyptian. This is like an old expression of pep, right? Like some energy. But of course, we have the idea of the serpent and the rising kundalini. So we have that, and then of course, monster energy drink just makes it completely explicit with the 666. Which of course Crowley associated with the sun.
Right.
Yeah, right. So this is, you know, this idea of it's the monster being the beast, but it's also again the sun. So it's just like your sunny delight or your rising sun. If 666 is the number of the sun, then your monster energy is again the old sun.
Yeah, and so Mountain Dew is also a pretty blatant biblical reference to the tall. Which is a very significant word Kabbalistically. The value of tall is 39, right? So there's this whole deal where that's the value of Yud-Heh-Vav if you spell it out. So if you spell out the letters, you end up with 39. And then if you add the final hey to Yud-Heh-Vav, then you get 45, which is the value of Adam and Ma. And so basically you're establishing this connection between Yadam once again and the Tetragrammaton for one, but Tal literally is Mountain Dew. I mean, it's a dew. And the reference to the dew on her head or whatever that all the Kabbalists take to be representative of the Shekhinah, and that the final hay is the Malkut, which is the Shekhinah. So you add that, it's this whole thing, which I found really interesting. And Mountain Dew, weird. Nice one.
And again, you have, like, as John wrote here, to the apex, right? This idea of the rising Kundalini, or to the top, or giving you energy, your rising sun, the Mountain Dew would be the same thing. You would be, dew is what you would find early in the morning. So this is the you know, you're on top of the mountain, rising in the morning.
Right. There's the connection in the value with Ma. You have, that's the first part of the word mana, which is what appeared in the morning for the Israelites when they were wandering in the desert.
Yes.
Mana's literal translation is a question, and it means, what is it? And it's the unknown substance that's nourishing. And so people take that to be, like, basically the spiritual fulfillment is nourishing, that it actually nourishes you so that you can endure the most intense situations if you're in touch with that source of energy, which is, once again, like Orgon or Kundalini or whatever, if it's not being restricted, and then becomes Mountain Dew.
You know, the 7-Eleven's slogan, "Oh, thank heaven," right? So, oh, thank heaven, I'm going to 7-Eleven to get me a Mountain Dew and a whatchamacallit.
Yeah. Of course, 7 of 7-Eleven intersects with Eve.
Yes, yeah.
11, so classic, and it's a red line through Eve. So, like, and then you have, obviously, 7-Eleven is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there to meet all your needs, just like Eve, what Eve sets in motion is something that affects us all the time, everywhere, you know, what's introduced there. And so, yeah, and that's also taken, so Eve, her foot is the foot that's, even though it doesn't directly say this, this is, it's presented by the Christians when they have the woman in Revelations has her feet on the moon or whatever. There's this whole, like, the holding of the serpent down with the foot, that the serpent can't reach the supernal realms. So it's squashed by the foot of Eve. And so you could take that as this 7-Eleven pointing to that.
But you could also look at that same image and compare it with, like, Kali standing on Shiva, where he's laying prone and he has the serpent and she has her foot on him.
Sure, yeah, the snake is long, 7 miles, you know. She's the 11, you know, it's the 7-Eleven. I came across together while studying this reference to the Samech Mem, which you'd say is Sam, right? Sam I Am, and Lamed, the lily, right? Where Lilith is actually taken as a serpent, and it literally said in Ramak's commentary that the Samech Mem is riding on the serpent in the underworld because it's the under tree. So it's talking about the tree behind the tree or underneath the tree or whatever, the substitute, which is hot. That literally she rides the serpent through it. I thought that was fucking weird. Oh, Spinal Tap.
Right, and Spinal Tap, so that's your Kundalini energy, is where they say, you know, this one goes up to 11.
Wow, that's a good one. I mean, I didn't even think about that when we did our blog, and I think it was Bill or Jason that put that at the top.
I think I connected that image to that post. That was a hell of a post.
Yeah, that was a fucking hell of a post.
So does anyone know why 7-Eleven is called, so if they're open 24/7, why are they called 7-Eleven? Do you know what the 11?
I don't know.
I mean, except for the obvious fact that they can get the word Eve in there.
I'm pretty sure it's because of what we're talking about.
Well, okay. So, well, in all seriousness, you guys have read what, you know, if you've read portions of Suicide Kings, I make the whole point that the number 77, right, which means Oz, which is Hebrew Oz, which means strength. We have the strength tarot card, which is essentially rising Kundalini, right? It would be the number is represented all through in the number 77. So, if your thing is called 7-11, well, 7-11s is 77, right? This idea of 77 being the rising Kundalini, I mean, it just sort of seems to. Again, I can't say this is all what they intended, that it's some sort of magic sigil for that, but that certainly would, I think, is a very clear-cut correlation.
No, it's perfect, because I mean, the Golden Dawn folks take Tet as the middle serpent letter, right? So you have the Lamed is the Lamed, I get used to saying that, is the rising Kundalini, but the Tet is it curled up. And so when she's basically taming the beast, the May Queen is there in the rider deck, you know, taming the beast, or she's riding the beast. That's basically holding the beast down, you know. So you could take it as that, or not just holding it down, but directing it, harnessing it, controlling it to whatever degree. And so,
precisely, because with the Kali and Shiva image, he's playing dead. So he's basically submitting to her, but the reason that snake is still rising up, where like he's laying down, but the snake is always shown with a little bit of a rise in it, is because it's showing that he still has this energy, he's just submitting it to her will. So the same thing, that lion is not laying down, he's just allowing himself to be rising in her service.
Yeah. Wow, what a trip. The letter, look at the letters of the Tet and the Samech, because Samech, it's literally like an Ouroboros if you take it as a serpent, because the serpent actually connects. And you can see that represented in the Wands cards, with the Royal Wands cards in the Rider deck, where the serpent gets closer to swallowing its tail in the sequence, or actually the lizard gets closer to following his tail in the sequence, whereas the King of Wands is actually, it's actually a full circle, and he's got a lizard at his side, but then he is obviously, the King of Wands is the lizard king in that regard, and then obviously ride the snake. It's pretty perfect. But
hey, John, were you the one who wrote on Facebook about Always Record saying more Mason than Freeman, less lizard than Ike, or something like that?
Yeah, that was me.
That, I think, is my favorite description so far of the show.
Oh, cool.
Wow. Hi. Thank you. On the front of the it's right there with Always Record as a description.
That'd be good.
I would like that. How do you feel about that, Alan? You want to throw that underneath the Always Record thing as a description, right on our header, or is that?
Sure. Yeah. That's awesome.
Holy shit! I'm getting cooler and cooler here.
Bill says it's t-shirt time. You know, my wife's been asking me for like all week, when are you making t-shirts? And I was like, I don't think anyone would wear a t-shirt. She's like, no, you got to have something like, you know, sink is sexy or something. And I was like, I'm going to make a t-shirt that says, I have sex while listening to 42 minutes. Or, you know, I was just like being like sort of silly, but Bill, I think you're right. It's t-shirt time.
Baby thong.
Baby tees and thongs. That's what the kids like.
Nice.
Baby thongs with, okay, never mind.
I started calling Always Record to my friends because you're supposed to be out on Thursdays and often you're not. I always call it Always Retard.
I don't know if I'm insulted by that.
No, just a little late. Yeah, it's funny. Come on.
No, it's all good.
Yeah, yeah.
It's going always.
We always We always record on Thursdays, but we don't always get everything edited and put online.
Yeah, of course. It's some stuff to do. And you always have to make your little sign. I like that. That was really cool. The, I don't know, the page, the... Where the thing you sent me on Facebook, always recorded with my name on it and stuff and my art.
Yeah, I make an. You should make an image for every episode.
I guess. Yeah, that's what I mean. That's also what takes time.
Oh sure, yeah. Yeah, you know, so we've figured out a pretty nice little thing here where Bill's been recording, I've making the images, and one of us will usually upload it. Bill's been handling a lot of that lately, and. What we need to figure out, this is a question I guess I can ask you, because I've been, I don't know if this is interesting to listen to, but it's a question I'd really like to ask you, is that if someone finds, you know, an MP3 on their computer that's like episode 38, part 3, you know, it's just sort of this random thing, do you have a sense of where this even came from 5 years later, or, you know, should there be something like that put on there? Listening to it, does it, is there an ease of understanding what flows into what and things like that?
Well, I used to go to the Happy Creatures and then go to SyncBook, and then from SyncBook to whatever podcast, to the latest one, but now I just have it on iTunes.
Correct.
Each show usually has one, two, or three episodes or whatever, and they usually stand on their own. You know, I can start listening to an episode, to episode part two, and it'll make sense. You know, is that what you mean?
Oh, yeah, basically, yeah.
Yeah, and it always says, you know, like next to the link, it'll tell you a little bit, like who's on it or whatever. Like even if it's episode two or part two of episode 39, it'll say with whoever, so it makes sense. You can always tell.
Yeah, I'm glad you went for the iTunes route because iTunes is set up really nice.
Yeah, yeah.
I've been working on fixing the archives for the people who just click the MP3 from the website. There's, you know, the SyncBook.com, so I always record. I have just all those little play buttons where people can listen to the episodes. And what I've started doing is cleaning up those archives because they all work as audio, but if you download them into your iTunes, let's say you downloaded a single episode into your iTunes, it shows up as like TS something something dot MP3 or whatever. Just as like a file.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. I didn't know that.
And I found a way to clean that up, but it's just incredibly time consuming. I spent my weekend this past weekend.
Oh, yeah.
I spent the whole weekend working on it, and I only got through the first five episodes. So, yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sure that's not really that interesting, but I just sort of, like I said, this is, for me, this is a slightly selfish way of getting to kind of get a sense of what it's like to listen to it, not being sort of involved in it. Like, I know if I'm not here for a week, I really enjoy listening to it, but there is one frustrating thing about this show, because... Because it's sort of just free-flowing conversation, anytime I listen to an episode where I'm not here, I'm sitting there going, oh my God, why didn't they say this?
Or, yeah. Well, that's why I'm so excited to be here, is I'm sort of the guy on the outside, and I can answer questions like that. And it's I was the same thing. I'm like dying to like, no, but you forgot about this part.
Yeah. I watched this the Sync Jack video, and I told Jake when he had it on that it was just so much that I was just like, oh, but, and I mean, it's such a long video, but there's these things that I'm just like, oh, how could you miss that? The fucking Joker talking about purple right after you show the color purple. Oh, what about fucking John Turturro in Box of Moonlight? You got to show the box and then show Barton Fink with the box and then show Jack in the box, obviously. But yeah, so I don't know.
That's what I did with the refrigerator thing. I was wondering if, like, because you didn't actually, you asked the question, how does a refrigerator, like, how do you get a time machine out of a refrigerator? And I was thinking, you put food in there to make the food last longer. You put it into a cryogenic chamber. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like slowing time, right?
Yeah.
This is Are you guys familiar with, there's this guy, I can't think of the guy's name. There's this institute. This guy has come out claiming that they have not necessarily time travel technology, but time control technology. And basically what they're doing is they're able to create pockets of either sped up time or slowed down time. And they're saying this is, you know, a technology they have. They're calling it time control, not time travel. And that they can create a pocket. So let's say you put the little pocket around a plant, you could speed up the time around that plant and make the plant grow in, you know, 3 days or something instead of 3 weeks. But it's interesting to me is that the refrigerator is essentially that same thing. It's a pocket of slowed down time, in at least in a metaphorical sense.
Hmm.
Well, no, it's not even metaphorical. It sort of, it does do that, right? Like, it's sort of like a dragonfly. The space between its brain and its nerves is shorter, so it sort of lives in a different time span than we do. And
right.
when you put things into a refrigerator, that's kind of what you're doing. You're putting them into a different time span. Right? You're making all the microbes in there, their lifespan sort of gets stretched out, right? So they're not, they can't go through their process, as their life process, as quickly, and it stretches out time for them. And that's
It's like like a gnat or like a fruit fly has like a 48-hour lifespan. It's like if we lived for 48 hours, we would think it's like your whole life is like, oh my god, what's going on? Oh my god, I gotta eat, and I have to try and have sex, and oh, I'm dead. It's like, no, it's not really life. It's all relative.
Yeah.
Uh huh. So
speaking of time, sorry, David.
Speaking
of time, did you see what Bill dropped here? He's gonna have to go in 15 minutes, and he's the one recording. And since I'm at my job, I don't have a way to record here. So we're basically gonna have to wrap up in the next 15 minutes. So I want if John, there was something you wanted to focus on, I wanted to throw that out there. And I'm sorry to cut you off, David, but
go ahead, David.
Oh. Last night I was thinking about, Alan, how you mentioned that, you know, you have the actual quote from, is it the Gita or Upanishads or whatever, but the I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
Correct.
And how you were saying that it's actually time. So it's I am become death, or I am become time,
I am
the destroyer of worlds. I was considering how, you know, the spherot of the tree are literally taken to be correspondent worlds, but they're literally worlds, spiritual worlds, that when you have Da'at emerge, it's taken symbolically actually to be, in certain places, a strangling serpent. And so I was thinking about, like, the idea of the spin in the garden is taken as at time itself, because duality is time. As soon as you introduce duality, you've introduced time, which is our 7-Eleven, right? And so it was just occurring to me that literally, as far, even though the worlds might exist on some level, the fact that we could be cut off from our greater spiritual worlds is actually really appropriate. Just to do a culture jump and kind of be theosophical about it, I couldn't help but like make that action last night.
Yeah, I had a friend, I used to be really interested in economics. I mean, I still am to an extent, but I had a friend who used to always like to point out that when they talk about, you know, models, economic models, you usually have, you know, it's your simple supply and demand, right? And you just make this like simple little graph. And what they found was that once you insert time, if you have supply, demand, and time, or anything where once you insert the concept of time into any of the existing models, the entire model would fall apart. Time destroyed the world. Right.
Right. So there's the an economist, the guy who came up with black swan theory in economics. You know about that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, he initially was looking at 9/11 as something that was not like had this equation that they, this model they were using, and everything was in accordance to the model. And then it was like, you know, something comes along that's unprecedented or that's not accounted for. And so you have this variable that's introduced can throw the entire thing off. And just what that has meant in history in terms of that these things emerge that were like, wow, we hadn't taken that into account. And so I was considering, like, that's the idea, like in the garden, that everything is perfect. And then this thing is introduced that's just completely foreign and unreconcilable, that just sets something into motion. You know, you have your Persephone and Demeter, you know, winter being introduced, where it's like, well, that wasn't something that was accounted for. And so that's, you could look at that on an optimistic level too. It's like, you know, I mean, we made up money in the first place, you know, it's like, it's like things can, are subject to change here, you know?
And yet take it back to when we talked about the river of shit, right? It's like once, if everything's gold, everything's frozen, then nothing moves. So you said, well, yeah, it might stink, but it might stink, but it moves. It's the same idea where even there's the idea of the Orphic egg, you know, this idea of the serpent of time. This again is the serpent being equated with time wrapped around the egg of creation. And essentially that strangling serpent kind of cracks the egg, and it's this serpent of coiled time kind of brings life into existence. So it's sort of like, well, you could just be a golden egg. You could have the you know, the goose who lays the golden egg, and hey, you have this perfect thing, but that's a pretty sterile world where nothing's ever really comes out of it. A golden egg doesn't hatch, but an egg with that sort of dirty snake strangling it will crack open and we'll have all sorts of interesting things happen. John, you brought up that idea earlier where it says, you could play bad music, you can add this element of evil, but it's only going to make my composition all the more interesting.
Yeah. The other thing about the river of shit that turns into gold, just because it turns into gold doesn't mean you can't move on it. You can always slide across the top. I got a paddle for that.
you got a niche for every paddle for that?
it's got a spike on the end.
There's this whole thing that I'm excited to keep looking at the section of the Zohar that I've been looking at, in the commentary going into, I mean, it's in the text itself of the Zohar, it's indicated, but if you look at there's a symbol that's called a zarka, that's a musical symbol that appears throughout the Torah, but they don't know why it's shown up above certain letters. There's no real explanation. Even musically, it's like this, but it's actually an infinity symbol. And this person who we're looking at, Ramak, when he says, he's like, if you take the Zarka to be a serpent, then he follows a slew of implications that come with that. So he's like, okay, this is a leap, but if you take this leap, what does it mean? And so what he ends up basically proving is if you just make that one assumption, it also means that the Torah itself is written on the skin of the serpent in the garden, and that this is like the Torah is meant to be shed in time, but is like a temporary thing to keep things in relative balance in the midst of what's taken place, which is just fucking far out as far as I'm concerned. And then he also has a deal that the curtain that surrounds the ark is also taken to be serpent skin as well. It's like all the serpent gets put in all these places if you take the Zarka as a serpent. And it's an infinity, so it's like a sideways S that is like kind of like the M.C. Escher ants crawling around the infinity symbol, because it's like it expresses that it goes behind itself. That's actually like three, you could get it as three dimensional just because it's a sideways S, like the loop goes behind it, you know. But yeah, I was tripping out on that in the film Pi. You know, you have the ant was Max's revelation when he stopped himself from killing the ant, and he looked at it closely, was when he saw the, he had his vision, you know, he had his revelation. So I thought that was interesting in terms of M.C. Escher's classic infinity ant.
Those are called like Mobius strips. Sideways eight infinity. And it's funny because John is the only one of you that's seen the image I made for this episode. I sent it to John just to say, hey, you know, I made this, so you cool with this? And basically one of the things I added, he has these two spoons that he made that are designed to nest together. It's sort of like a yin yang. These two spoons, which I thought were beautiful. Yeah, and I sort of placed that in the center of the image, and he wrote back to me saying, "I like that you put this eight on its side." And I wasn't sure if you wrote that was, you know, your spoons.
Yeah, I knew
but
exactly.
But it's
going
just funny. Yeah, I figured you did, but I was like, okay, this eight on its side. And I'm like, it's funny because now here you're talking about this sort of infinity piece and as the same idea of the infinity or symbol or the eight on its side or the S on its side. And that's actually already been incorporated into the image for this episode. So it's a nice
totally.
Little sync to
end on.
Go ahead.
The two of discs in Crowley's deck. You know, I'm looking at this, and it didn't even occur to me because new association of the Zarka and the serpent. It's literally the Zarka with a serpent. So you're look and with a crown on his head. So it's like
the yin and yang.
Completely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's perfect.
Cool.
Yeah, I love that image. That's a beautiful card.
Yeah, it looks good.
Oh, and then you have the fact that the two of discs is the one that whoever comes out with a new tarot deck uses as their card to put their names on. And so the Jodorowsky deck has Jodorowsky's name on the two of discs. And then Jodorowsky, the person, when he stopped doing film, he ended up doing comic books with Mobius.
Ah, yes. The Mobius.
And that image that you made is actually
comic
two
strip.
Discs, right? Because I had that the flower of life is a circle, and then it's on my coffee table, which is a big hunk of log. So you're looking down at the end grain.
Yeah.
Two discs.
Cool.
Did Mobius do blueberry?
Oh, I don't know about that. Maybe that'd probably.
You know the movie with the huge ayahuasca trip at the end?
I've heard about it. I've never seen it.
It's unbelievable. It's absolutely.
When I spent one night at Steve Wilner's house last summer. Two summers ago. I spent one night at Steve Wilner's house, and I was completely sober. But I went to sleep completely sober. I had the craziest, most psychedelic dream I've ever had in my life. And I woke up the next day, and I was just like, oh, this is crazy shit happened. And then, like, they start talking about this movie, Blueberry, and what they're describing is my dream from the night before. And I'm like, how the hell are you talking about my dream? I had these,
you
like, aisle.
Yeah, it's known as Blueberry in France, but it's Renegade in America.
Okay.
And one of the screenwriters for that movie is a guy who wrote most of Polanski's stuff. I can't think of his name right now. Let me figure
Ira Levine?
No. Let's see here. He apparently was kind of a recluse and didn't really go out or really kind of, you know, I don't know. Gerard Brock. He wrote Repulsion, The Vampire Killers, Bitter Moon, lots of stuff for Polanski.
Mm-hmm.
And so I haven't.
That's what day with. We were dipping into the Polanski web.
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, maybe you can confirm for me, is the Blueberry is the one where it has this ayahuasca serpents in it, right?
Yeah.
So we have this idea of Mobius Strip as the infinite serpent, and here you have the ayahuasca serpents. It's pretty pretty direct hit.
Absolutely. Oh,
yeah, I haven't looked at Blueberry. I saw that at the end of the film, that it's Mobius. And I was like freaking out to Amy. I was like, oh my God, that was Mobius? Wow, he's really come along. Jesus Christ, since heavy metal. That was definitely the closest depiction to ayahuasca that I've by far that I've ever come across. If I wanted to tell anybody without doing ayahuasca what ayahuasca is like, I would point them in that direction. And that's actually the head of the ayahuascan church that's in that film. which is often understand the deal within that in that film why they do like a cross cultural thing, like it's like supposed to be Mexico or something, and they have this Native American deal. And if you look in the room, there's peyote in there also. Like I'm like, what? It doesn't really fit. But whatever. I mean, it's him. I don't know what they're trying to communicate there. Maybe it's just something about other cultures having wisdom and that they wanted to include the Native Americans within that, you know.
If you want to know what ayahuasca is like without taking ayahuasca, just spend the night at Wilner's house. do you know, we have a funny sync here also. Do you know Jim Sanders, Peruvian ayahuasca shaman, is actually on the cover of National Geographic this week?
Wow.
I saw they were putting that on Facebook. Wow. Look at Jay Kotz's Facebook page. Maestro Juan Flores, there's a few pictures of him in Sync Book Volume 1. He's on the cover of National Geographic.
Wow, cool. I hope that's a good thing. I mean, I never know with the, you know, like...
Sure.
The attention of some people doesn't, you know... well, at the same time, though, you know, whatever, get it out there and stuff, but...
Well, I had a thing yesterday where I was saying that Hillary Clinton is going to be going off to do some ayahuasca sessions before she runs for president, and that's going to be an element of her campaign. So watch for it. We'll see.
That would be really interesting.
Because what's the last taboo or a cultural taboo for a presidential nominee? I mean, we've had the female, nominee. We've had a minority nominee. The outwardly plant therapy psychedelic president. We can get it all wrapped up into one with Hillary. Who knows?
Well, wasn't the, I mean, it's funny because we had Bill Clinton who admitted to smoking weed and Obama who admitted to snorting coke, I believe.
I do mushrooms.
What's that?
I do mushrooms.
All right, you'll be the next president. What I was going to say though is that I think there was a woman running last election cycle who was used to be affiliated with some sort of Wiccan, like priesthood. I'm trying to remember who she was, but was she running for maybe Congress or Senate? And they made a big deal out of the fact that she had these, witchcraft roots, that she was openly into witchcraft. And,
I remember that.
The religious right sort of, lampooned her for that. And I thought that was fascinating, is like here we are in 2012 and or I guess now we're in 2013. But, you know, the idea that how far have we come that that's still a sort of stigma of someone interested in esoteric ideas. So I wonder if I feel like psychedelics are actually more acceptable at this point than, open practice of magic. This is why it's still the idea that, oh, someone's affiliated with Freemasonry or someone's affiliated with such and such. It's still always painted in the conspiracy. Like, if they're affiliated with it, it must be evil. I feel like that could be a sort of frontier as well. So I want to see if Hillary Clinton runs for president on ayahuasca. I want her to have be sitting in a giant pentagram on the floor or something.
I have a real hard time thinking of Hillary taking ayahuasca.
Can you imagine what she'd have to face? All the fucking children she'd kill?
I just see a breakdown, iguana in the bathtub,
But it would be better for her to take ayahuasca than to not take ayahuasca.
Sure. Oh, of course. Yeah, I'd say that for just about anybody, but yeah.
But anyway, this is the idea when people talk about the idea that the Catholic Pope, or the Catholic Church is founded on this idea of mushroom worship. I find that a really hard leap because I would think if you've taken magic mushrooms, you're not going to be the total douchebag Pope that we've had for thousands of years. How do you take mushrooms and then decide you're going to, suppress intelligence and dominate the world and all this sort of stuff? If you've really had a psychedelic experience, I don't see how that's possible.
I talked to my rabbi the other day about Bohemian Grove, and telling him that these people do probably do psychedelics, and he was like, well, apparently not. And so I thought that that was kind of funny.
What did he say? Apparently what?
Not enough.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's sort of my point. Exactly. So I can't see how, you know, I had said years ago, I was talking to someone and I said that Dick Cheney, this was during the Bush administration, I said Dick Cheney should be force-fed LSD and, you know, just be forced to, like, watch. I want to fucking strap him down Clockwork Orange style and make him watch all the torture that he's inflicted on people and things like that. No, I'm not.
Yeah. Well, Dick Cheney, admittedly, aerosol LSD, he was part of the MK Ultra aerosol LSD over a city in France. Sent many people to a mental hospital. A couple people died.
You should see the fucking squirrels in that region. They're just insane.
It's a true fucking story. That's like admitted as disclosed information that we did that. But it was Dick Cheney. What the fuck? Have fun, guys. I wouldn't do it, but you go right ahead.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know. It would be a terrible thing to do to somebody, someone as terrible as that. Like, I don't know if I believe an eye for an eye. You know, that'd be a really messed up thing to do to somebody. And at the same time, how do you stop someone who doesn't want to face the fact that they're murdering people around the world? How do you get them to face it?
But to see, that's so heavyweight because the machine is running, right? It's like a car without a driver. And people get in to jump in while it's going like 75 miles per hour. How do you stop the killing machine? You know, I don't know if that's possible for any human being to do, you know, because when you hit the brakes, it's going to shred the shit out of whatever path it's already on. And it's such a huge conversation to jump into as we're trying to wrap up.
Sure.
But, you know,
we'll save that for another time. It's an excellent point. But I could argue that the other side of that, but I think you're right. John, I really want to give you the last word here. First off, a huge thank you to you for joining us. And actually, even more than that, I want to thank you for being interested in it. Like, the fact that you said, you know, hey, this is what I really would want, is to be a guest on this show. It was just sort of a very flattering experience. And I want to thank you for that. And thank you for joining us. It was really good to get to talk to you. And I want to give you the last word here.
All right. Well, one little sync. When I was reading the sync book and I came to your chapter, I had never seen your face before. Mm-hmm. And you have that cartoon in it, the comic. And the young boy in the comic, that's what I thought you looked like. Sort of straight, bowl cut hair, blonde. Kind of almost exactly like that kid. That was my imagination. That was pretty neat. And yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. I was very, very excited, and all my dreams have come true now.
we can have you again on sometime too.
That would be wicked. Any time. Every week if you want.
John, I appreciate the kind words, but please dream bigger. We need a...
Of course. Nice.
I'm kidding. Guys, an absolute pleasure. Good talking to you. Bill, you send me the audio. I'm not sure what we're doing next week. Is the 14th. We might have... we might be talking about Kubrick and some interesting information that Andras and I, sort of comparing notes, came across a sort of strange Kubrick timeline that I think you'll find very interesting.
Awesome.
Ooh.
Cool. Send me some addresses, guys. I'll send you some sink spoons.
Right on.
Appreciate it. Everyone check out CanadianDipsticks.blogspot.ca. Beautiful stuff. Thanks again.
Take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
If I were a carpenter, you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby? If a tinker were my trade, would you still find me carrying the pots I made following behind me. Save my love for sorrow, save my love for lonely. I've given you my tomorrow, love me only. If I work my hands in wood, would you still love me? You answer me quick, Tim, I could. How put you above me? If I were a miller at a mill wheel grinding, would you miss your colored blocks, soft shoes shining? Save my love for loneliness, save my love for sorrow. I've given you my onlyness, given me your tomorrow. If I were a carpenter, you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Could you have my baby?